from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Last night, a proud President Bush stood before the nation and declared that the State of the Union is confident and strong. His message extolled the power and the virtue of American citizens and their democracy.
Our generation has dreams of its own, and we also go forward with confidence. The road of Providence is uneven and unpredictable, yet we know where it leads. It leads to freedom.
But just what that freedom is, what it means, and what it protects appears to be lost on a portion of America's young when it comes to a central pillar of American freedoms, the First Amendment, the freedom of speech. A survey of more than 100,000 high school students out this week finds that 35% of teens think the First Amendment goes too far in the rights it guarantees. 75% don't know how they feel about it, and half of the teens surveyed said that newspapers should not be allowed to publish stories without government approval. In other words, censorship. Tonight on Point, young Americans unschooled in American freedoms and the future of the First Amendment. You can join the conversation tonight. Do the findings here surprise you? As George Bush talks about freedom around the world, who's getting the word to our own population, our own kids here at home? Are America's young people getting the civic education they need to live in freedom? Join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Storrs, Connecticut, is Kenneth Doutrick, professor of public policy at the University of Connecticut and director of the new study funded by the Knight Foundation and out this week, The Future of the First Amendment Project. Kenneth Doutrick, thanks for being with us tonight.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack. Good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Kenneth Doutrick, take us into these numbers. The headlines look pretty scary. A considerable chunk of American high school students say the First Amendment goes too far, government should censor newspapers, and on and on. First of all, who did you ask? What was the survey? How was it structured?
Well, the survey involved, we selected about 500 high schools from around the country, and we went into those schools and we interviewed students, principals, and teachers. And so we ended up with, as you mentioned, over 100,000 interviews with students. So we also ended up with about 8,000 interviews with teachers and about 400 interviews with principals. So it was really a comprehensive study looking not only at what students felt, but at what principals and teachers felt and kind of the impact of how, you know, teachers influence student opinions regarding the First Amendment.
Walk us through the key findings from American students, what they understood, what they didn't, what they supported, what they didn't in the First Amendment.
Yeah, I guess, you know, as you mentioned, kind of taking the First Amendment for granted, low support, low knowledge, I guess, is kind of the highlight of the survey. You mentioned the 35% number who say that the First Amendment goes too far. That was a bit startling. We also, in the past, have done adult national samples, and we found that students are about 10 points more likely to say the First Amendment goes too far and the rights it protects. But some of the other key findings related to that point, we asked students, do you ever think about First Amendment rights? Does it matter to you? And only 27% said yes. About three-quarters say they really never think about First Amendment rights, or they didn't know enough to even answer the question.
Okay, they're in high school. Is that unusual? Maybe high school kids just don't think about the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Maybe they think about, you know, girls and boys. And
well, certainly that's true. I mean, as people get older, they tend to think more about these things. But even so, you know, given that there is some instruction going on, and we've got civics and history classes, one would expect, I think, that number, and thinking about the security of the First Amendment into the future, one would hope that that number might be a little bit higher.
Take us on in. What else did you find?
We found that we asked students whether they agreed or disagreed with the following statement. Newspapers should be allowed to publish freely without government approval. Only 51% said yes. So we're finding that, you know, a bare majority of students favor the idea that government shouldn't be allowed to censor what newspapers print.
And put some meat on the bones of that number for us. That's really startling. Do you have any sense of what the students understood by that? Did they think that that's going on already, or that if it isn't, it should go on? That they want? Does it really mean they want government censors sitting in newsrooms around the country?
Well, it doesn't mean that they proactively support government censors, but they think it's okay for government to do the censoring. Now, putting this finding into context of adults across the nation, in our national adult surveys, we find that about 70 to 80% of adults agreed with that statement. So students are much less likely to support the idea of newspapers being able to publish freely than are their older counterparts. We also asked a series of questions about knowledge of the First Amendment. One of those questions was, do you think Americans have the legal right to burn the flag as a form of political protest? 75% of students said no. The correct answer, of course, is yes. So
that's a protected right.
There are lots of other numbers that we could cite here, but overall, these numbers are kind of indicative of all the other findings that we had in this survey, and that's that students largely take the First Amendment for granted. There's fairly low support, and there's not a whole lot of knowledge about First Amendment issues on the part of American high school students.
So many questions come out of this, Kenneth Dontrick. First of all, have surveys like this been done over time? Is this a fairly steady state among high school students, or is there a declining degree of commitment to, of support for the First Amendment?
Well, that's a great question. You know, we've done, since 1997, the Freedom Forum's First Amendment Center has commissioned us to do an annual national poll of adults, and so we can answer that question for the adults across the country, but this is really the first time that any comprehensive study has been done that focuses specifically on high school students. So it'll be important to monitor changes. You know, the Knight Foundation, the Freedom Forum, a number of other organizations are planning major initiatives aimed at programs in the schools to try to raise awareness of the First Amendment. We'll see if that has any impact. Hopefully it does.
Now, we should say that the Freedom Forum surveys show that among adults there's a remarkable kind of ambivalence about the First Amendment, too. If I'm reading this correctly, they say that the sort of levels of support go up and down depending on what's going on. In times of crisis, not so great. After the terrorist attacks in 2001, American adults were almost split evenly, 50-50, on the question of whether or not the First Amendment goes too far in the rights it guarantees.
Yeah, I mean, and that's probably not too surprising. You know, right after 9/11, security became a much more important concern for people than did individual liberty and freedom. And that's probably not too surprising. In times of crisis, when the salience of security issues is much higher, people are more willing to give up liberties such as First Amendment rights in order to feel as though they're secure and safe.
And even in good times, in stable times, about 30% of Americans, they find, feel the First Amendment, centuries-old cornerstone of the Bill of Rights, goes too far. But high school students are supposed to be the young, the idealistic, and one would think, being in school, the educated about these rights. How have you interpreted these findings, Kenneth? What do you make of this? What's going on or not going on that leaves students with these attitudes?
Well, you know, I think one of your earlier points, Tom, that, you know, what matters to high school students? We asked one question in the survey, agree or disagree with the idea that musicians should have the right to publish lyrics or sing songs with lyrics without government interference.
Mm-hmm.
And on that item, we find the highest percent of student support. 70% of students say that musicians should be able to sing whatever they want without government interfering with it. So
censor the newspapers, but let hip-hop say whatever it wants.
Well, but, you know, my point is that music is important to students. Young
mm-hmm.
people, you know, music is a very important thing. So things that tend to be more important to students tend to, you know, get a higher level of First Amendment support.
Did you do any breakdown within those 100,000 students? Were there, I don't know, students in a certain geographical area or of a certain mindset or experience that were more or less supportive of the First Amendment?
You know, we've really just begun to look at the data, but the most important difference when we break down students, those students who have had journalism courses, those students who have had instruction in the First Amendment, who have had civics classes that dealt with First Amendment material, are much more likely to be supportive and knowledgeable about the First Amendment than those students who haven't had such classes. And also those students who have participated in a student media activity, such as a student newspaper or a student radio station, those students are much more likely than those who haven't had those experiences.
But what about plain old civics class? Wouldn't that be emphasizing the importance of First Amendment freedoms, assembly, speech, the press, religion?
It does. Most civics classes should, and indeed those students who have had those classes are more supportive. What we see is about half, 50-52% of students say that they've had such courses in high school. So it's becoming, you know, a less and less staple part of the high school curriculum, which I think is something that school boards and, you know, schools that are dealing with curriculum issues need to focus on.
All of us. Jack Beatty, here we are, president talking about freedom around the world. We look at our own high school students, and they're kind of so-so about the First Amendment.
Yeah, and that's the only, it's the thing that's keeping some of us out of jail, you might say.
Yes, so freedom of the press, please, of speech.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, shocking stuff. But when you think about it, I mean, young people have no experience of free speech in their lives. They have something like government constraint in the school. You can't say this, you can't do that, you can't talk now. And then they have the other kind of constraint, the tyranny of the majority, the social pressure to get with it. So they haven't really had much, I'm trying to extenuate this a little bit, but they haven't had much experience in their lives with what we would call freedom of speech, and none with freedom of the press.
Well, they've got newspapers, but you're saying there's always a teacher looking over the shoulder and the principal on the school board.
That's right. And if not that, there's the peer group saying, conform, have the same opinion we do. Of course, you've got to fault the whole civics curriculum. And one has to wonder, you know, in a country, I mean, Oberlin, Ohio, allows for the teaching of evolution, but the teachers don't teach it because they're afraid of social pressure. I wonder if something like that is true of teaching the First Amendment, that it's so explosive. It touches on so many hot issues that teachers would just as soon let this cup pass from me, and we'll just mention it, and we won't tell people this is relevant to you.
Explosive centuries after the drafting of the U.S. Constitution, right there at the heart of the American democracy. Kenneth Dautrick, stand by. Jack Beatty, we're talking tonight about young Americans unschooled in American freedoms, rejecting the First Amendment and advocating government oversight of the press. You can join the conversation tonight. Who's teaching the fundamental American freedoms to our children? Is anyone? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about young Americans unschooled in American freedoms, rejecting the First Amendment. You can join the conversation tonight. As George Bush talks about freedom in the world, who's getting the word to our own population here at home? And students, are you being taught the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, in school in a way that sticks? Teachers, are you encouraged to give American freedoms the hard sell or do other things instead to go easy? And parents, do you think your kids know the fundamental American rights? Did you teach them? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kenneth Dautrick is with us. He's professor of public policy at the University of Connecticut, was director of the Future of the First Amendment Project. Kenneth Dautrick, we've just got you for another minute here. This project was funded by the Knight Foundation. Knight is in Knight Ridder. That's the business of the press. What are people with a direct interest, not that all Americans don't have it, but that kind of direct interest in the freedom of the press thinking about the kind of numbers you're producing, people in the news business?
Well, I think, you know, they're surprised at the extent of the lack of knowledge, lack of support. I think there's a general feeling that this might be a problem, but the extent to which students, you know, if you want to use a phrase, a lack of passion, people who study the First Amendment, you know, from a legal perspective or otherwise, are very passionate about First Amendment rights. And I think what is probably most surprising is not only a lack of passion, but a lack of even attention that most students are giving to, you know, these rights that have been around for more than 200 years.
Well, keep tracking it. Thanks for bringing us the numbers tonight, Kenneth Dautrick at the UConn. Thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure.
We're joined now from Nashville, Tennessee, by Gene Polosinski. He is executive director of the First Amendment Center. Gene, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good evening.
I'm sure this headline's turned your head. I'm sure you read very closely. What do you think of this survey? High school students, a third or more, saying First Amendment goes too far.
Well, we participate in the and actually conduct the annual State of the First Amendment survey, and this survey was built from that. And we're finding the same result among young people that we've found consistently since 1997 with adults. So it wasn't surprising. It was disappointing. There is some hope that younger people might have more value of freedom of expression. But we find now we know why adults have those views. They apparently pick them up when they're young people.
So what do you make of this? Are these freedoms of speech, of assembly, of religion, of the press, are they so kind of fundamentally revolutionary, explosive, in my colleague Jack Beatty's words, that they're always going to have people who can't buy in, who just are not on board?
Well, I think essentially you have a couple of things going on. One, there's a complacency about them. I think that Americans are so they're sort of so firmly rooted, fully rooted in our history that we take them for granted. We'll always have free speech kind of an attitude. So I think there's been somewhat of a lackadaisical idea that, you know, that's a given. Let's move on to other things. You touched on it a little bit, why they don't teach it in school. I think it's a very explosive subject many times, talk about free speech. We have a program called First Amendment Schools where we try to encourage a whole school approach to teaching, not just a civics class, but the whole school. You show it in student government, student publications, and the ability of students to join in and talk about what's going on in their school. And that, you know, that's a tough sell to an awful lot of administrators these days.
I wonder if it's possible that technology has a part in this, that students are seeing such a cascade of information on the Internet and sometimes pretty crazy information and saying, whoa, this is out of control. This isn't freedom. This is anarchy.
Well, unfortunately, I think what's happening is they're learning by example. I mean, a lot of American high schools today, there is a very strong restriction. Administrators are very willing to use a 1987 court decision called Hazelwood to restrict expression, to be very fearful of what students might say out loud. And again, they're not being taught formally these freedoms. We, as Ken mentioned, they're not really core curricula these days in a lot of testing on math and science. And I think it's kind of a combination of complacency and apathy and inattention.
What kind of speech does the Hazelwood decision protect or say is not protected?
What happened in that decision was the Supreme Court held that administrators, in order to protect an orderly education process, while they couldn't just randomly and at will restrict student expression, let's say there's a T-shirt with not necessarily an obscene slogan, but something that might cause the education process to be disrupted, they have the authority to say, you can't wear that T-shirt. If a student newspaper is going to disrupt in their minds the education process, they can censor that school newspaper. You know, students, in some ways, this reflects the fact that high school students in America probably have fewer First Amendment rights than any other constituent group in the country.
Jack Beatty, that goes to your point that in some large degree, students may be learning by direct example of their high school experience here.
They don't have any experience of it. They at home, they're under the parental thumb, and at school, it's under the proctoring of the teacher and the administrator, and then among their peers, it's do what's in. But of course, they vote. At 18, they're voting, and that's the connection that it's harder and harder to kind of connect those two things.
Jack, it sounds like you've got an outspoken companion right there.
I've got a free speech issue here, my own.
A free spirit right under your leg there in the hills of New Hampshire. Gene Polosinski, what about it? You know, we talk about free speech being explosive. There have been many times in American history when there were issues considered explosive. In the 50s, just to talk about, there was the Red Scare and all kinds of things that were taboo. These days, I don't know, maybe we're talking about diversity or cultural, cross-cultural issues. I'm not sure where the roughest lines are. But are there? Do you feel like there are more constraints these students are seeing in their everyday experience of speech, free speech, the lack of it today than in other periods?
Well, I think that we have to remember, since 2001, since the 9/11 attacks, the prime motivator in a lot of American policy has been response to fear, the fear of attack. We have, you know, I understand that administrators and teachers have to worry also about school safety. There's a tremendous pressure now to produce certain kinds of results on tests, so you have a kind of a confluence of things, and that's, if you want to talk about a perfect storm for the First Amendment, in a way, First Amendment and free expression at various times has made Americans uncomfortable, or simply, frankly, fearful, and they've reacted with a spasm of restrictions. But there's almost kind of this perfect storm idea of a number of factors coming to play right now. So I think high school students, both legally and socially, are facing a lot more restrictions than may have been there in the past.
And yet, especially when we're talking about freedom around the world, we'd like it to be bright and shining here at home. Listeners, you can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Daniel's calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hi. I am one of those youngins that y'all keep on talking about.
Oh, good. What do you think?
Well, there's something I want to read to you first. This is from Thomas Paine, Common Sense. And it says, quote, "There is something exceedingly ridiculous in the composition of a monarchy. It first excludes a man from the means of information, yet empowers him to act in cases where the highest judgment is required. The state of a king shuts him out from the world, yet the business of a king requires him to know it thoroughly." this, I think, is actually really apt in this conversation, not so much in the form of government, but in the form of science that's been used to conduct the survey.
Tie it in for us. I'm not following you yet, Daniel. What's your point here?
Okay, well, my thing is this. I am young. I am 23 years old, recently out of high school. I got a civics education. Got a great one. Got it at the wrong time. Most of us, when we're being taught civics, we're being taught when we're 14, 15 years old.
Before you're really out in the world and may know the value of it, but did you end up supporting the First Amendment?
See, that's the thing. I blame the generations before us, actually. I think they have locked us into a really nasty place because you have a lot of opportunistic people taking advantage of the press. We know more. My generation right now probably knows more about the breakup of Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston than people know what went on in the State of the Union. But that is why my generation is sick of the media.
So you see it as a kind of a exploitative business instead of a sacred institution?
Pretty much. I mean, it very much comes across that way, especially to people of my generation. Now, to say that we don't care about the First Amendment, I think it was blown out of the water by a statement given earlier because when you all were talking about music, you know, because this, yes, it is something that we feel very passionate about.
Mm-hmm. So we shouldn't walk past that. That's a kind of statement in itself, you're saying.
It's a major statement because most of my generation, when I was in high school, I was highly influenced by the music I listened to, and same with all my peers. You know, we're learning our moral values from Britney Spears. You know, I'm sure every parent of a young daughter right now is cringing to hear that.
They're all voting against the First Amendment as fast as they can, I suppose.
Probably.
No, I'm kidding. But I hear you. Daniel, you raise a whole gamut of great points there. Jack Beattie, let me go to you first with that. I mean, there's the kind of news from the front. Look, we're looking at the media, says this 23-year-old American, and it looks like a business. And it's protected by the Constitution, but it's not necessarily working in our best interest. And we're more ready to assign the freedom to music where we see more credibility.
And they are right. The news is a business. I mean, the three networks are owned by, well, one of them is owned by GE, one by Westinghouse, and one by Disney, and who knows else. They're vast corporations, and they have interests, and there are things that they report, and there are things that they don't report. We know that about NBC, for example, with issues affecting GE. So, and then they turn on the television, and they see what you might call the controversy issue, industry, you know, the crossfires,
right.
the food fights.
You fool, you idiot.
You idiot. Let's. This is free speech? Is this the dignity of Democratic debate? Is this? No, they see what that is. That's all about trying to get ratings. So, it doesn't look like such a sacred institution.
Gene Polosinski, how about it? Is the media business somehow feeding a cynicism that may lead to a loss of support for the core freedom?
Well, the quick answer is yes. I think I want to applaud your caller, by the way, for being familiar with the work of Thomas Paine, one of the great original pamphleteers of the American Revolution. But, you know, we've did a, in our survey in 2001, we asked sort of the general question, how valuable to the American government or the American way of life are these freedoms? And they all ranked 8, 9 out of 10. But every year we ask, does the press in America have too much freedom? And that's gone from between 40 and 50%, depending on, if you will, media excesses of coverage going on. So I explain that to my colleagues in the media by saying, ladies and gentlemen, the American public still has a great reverence for freedom of the press and the other freedoms, but they don't like the press they have at the moment.
So don't underestimate the young. They may be seeing things with all too clear an eye in some dimensions. I want to welcome another voice into our conversation. Peter Levine is joining us from Washington tonight. He's deputy director of the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement. Peter Levine, thanks for being with us.
Sure.
You pay a lot of attention to how civics get taught to the America's young people. What's the health of that education these days? Are schools and school systems committed to teaching American students their rights?
There's been a lot of erosion of what we call the civic mission of schools over the years. One of the basic functions of a school is to prepare people to be citizens, not just workers, not just potential soldiers, but citizens. And there really has been a loss of focus on that.
What's the evidence of that? Just fewer hours spent on it? What's happening?
Fewer hours is definitely part of it, and a narrowing of the curriculum. I mean, germane to this conversation, there used to be a course that was really quite common called Problems of Democracy. It went under different names at different schools. And that was, of course, where you read the newspaper and discussed it in class and wrote short papers about it. And that class is almost completely gone.
What's the time frame of this erosion of teaching civics, of teaching the Constitution, rights and obligations? When did they begin to diminish?
Well, actually, the course I just mentioned tended to disappear around the early 1970s. And the usual explanation there is that the course got too hot to handle.
Too hot to handle because the issues in the public eye were too hot to handle.
Yeah. And community, right in communities, not as a national politics question.
So it was all right as long as it was all Norman Rockwell communities, but when things got funky, it got hard.
Well, and a lot of the personal, political kind of issues got into classrooms. But the other period that's been problematic is just the last few years, when the tremendous emphasis on preparing kids to pass tests in reading, math, and science has so far tended to squeeze out social studies and government.
Wouldn't that be ironic if we pumped the test scores up a couple of points and forgot the Constitution?
Yeah, it's also probably not a good way to pump up the test scores, because actually you've got to read content in order to do well on the tests, and that includes a lot of good content is history and social studies, and but they tend to, especially in the lower grades, they tend to focus right in on the kind of the mechanics of reading.
Look at this politically for us, Peter Levine. Where does the most support for civics education, teaching American freedoms and responsibilities, come from? Where's the greatest opposition? Is it from the right, from the left? How does it break down?
I believe that there's a pretty good bipartisan movement now for civic education, and I've been part of those discussions. I don't think it breaks down in a simple right-left way. There are certainly oppositions on both the right and the left to conventional ways of doing civic education, and probably often both sides have a point. But I think the problem is not so much, active ideological opposition, but a lack of priority predominantly.
And what about when things are considered too hot to handle? Is that because the left doesn't like language that's opposed to, inclusion, or the right doesn't like language that's politically challenging or about evolution? I don't know.
Yeah, well, there's some of both of that, and one of the great examples is that the history textbooks have to pass adoption in both. They have to be bought by both the state of California and the state of Texas, because those are the two biggest markets, and they have unified adoption committees, and they basically wipe out of the textbooks anything that's controversial to either side.
A pretty tough screen that begins right there at the textbook. John's calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Thank
you
thanks
for taking my call.
Sure.
Just to sort of, I guess, parallel what was just being said, is that it seems to me that a lot of the results that you're talking about are a function of the fact that there's been more and more of a focus over the past 15 years or so on teaching kids what to think as opposed to teaching them how to think. And I think things like the whole book business that goes on in California and Texas, this fixation on treating creationism as an equal science to evolution, sex education, all of these things seem to be more focused on this is what you're supposed to think as opposed to here's how you think. Come up with your own decisions about it.
But, John, isn't the teaching the what of the Constitution important? I mean, ideally everyone understands why as well and thinks it through, but at least teaching the significance, importance, value of these freedoms.
It's very important. I mean, I'm old enough to remember having been in a class called Problems of Democracy, mm-hmm. where we read the paper and looked at the Constitution and looked at the First Amendment, looked at the Bill of Rights and said, where does this stuff apply? And what are the implications of this? But it wasn't telling us this is what you're supposed to think. It was about come up with some thoughts on your own. And I don't see that happening in education today. I've taught on the post-secondary level most recently, and a lot of these kids are what I would call drones. I mean, that's what I'm experiencing.
Why? Because they're being waved away from more active engagement?
It's tell me what's on the test and tell me how to get what's on the test and then give me the test.
Yep, there's the testing. John, thanks very much for your call. Peter Levine, but would you be happy to have civics included in that tested material? At least that would get the basics out there in front of everybody.
I'm not sure that's the whole answer to just having tests for civics, and there's a reasonable resistance to piling on another test when we have so many.
Yeah.
But you could do good tests that really got to critical thinking and to deep knowledge, not just trivia. And you could also incorporate onto existing tests more civic and political content.
How many hours of civics education or how many courses do most American high school students get when they graduate, by the time they graduate?
Slightly less than one. I mean, I was actually interested when I think Ken Dautrich said that only 50% of their sample had a class.
So one class in the course of their pre-graduation education.
Well, but his sample, they're not all graduated yet. So by the time they graduate, you're going to get something like 80%, 79%, 80% having had a course.
But not too much. Peter Levine, Gene Polosinski, Jack, please stand by. We're talking tonight about young Americans unschooled in American freedoms, rejecting the First Amendment. You can join the conversation. What mindset would lead young Americans to back away from the First Amendment? How do you interpret these numbers? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about young Americans unschooled in American freedoms, rejecting the First Amendment, the freedom there guaranteed of the press, of speech, of assembly, of religion, saying, well, a third, more than a third, saying it goes too far. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Whatever happened to civics class, to our teaching of American rights and responsibilities? Does the press, the media, just look like another business now, not like a pillar of American democracy? Who's teaching the children, and what are they learning? What are they not learning? 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight from Nashville by Gene Polosinski, Executive Director of the First Amendment Center. From Washington by Peter Levine, Deputy Director of the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement. Our own Jack Beattie is here. And right now, Ben is calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Ben. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Great. Thanks
for my call. I guess my comment and a direction I'd like to look at is I teach at the university, and the students I'm getting are products of the culture. And the culture that they're getting is this right-wing, fundamentalist, evangelical approach to things. I teach a law and ethics course. We can't talk about ethics. It's morality. And so what I get in response of any kind of effort to take a look at rights of others and rights of minority and those kind of issues, it really comes down to this is what I believe because this is what the Bible says and there's no other discussion.
So your students are conservative, but they're not conservative in a way, to your view, that supports the freedoms guaranteed in the Constitution.
Well, freedoms, but I mean, when you talk about the freedoms of religion, that means other religions other than Christian. When you talk about freedoms of minorities, then we're talking about gays. When you talk about those kind of freedoms, it's like, fine, music is great, but let's don't go into the areas that really affect us culturally, because that's too threatening, I believe.
Ben, hang on. I want to put that to Peter Levine. Peter, do you see religious fundamentalism bleeding into the common understanding of school-age Americans of what freedoms are, how far they should go?
Well, it's a big country, and I don't want to disagree with the caller who's got his own students to look at, but actually, I mean, young people are very positive about gay rights, for example, and gay marriage, and even a majority of evangelical Christian young people are in favor of domestic partner benefits for gays. And we've found a generational change fairly powerful in which each generation enters more favorable towards gay rights and each generation then becomes slightly less favorable. They become more conservative as they get older, but the youngest... So now that's just one issue, and there's a whole range of issues, but I think young people are often quite... libertarian. To me, the two things that really stand out are one, that I don't think they like the press, and we've talked mm-hmm. about that. I'm glad that came up. I wanted to bring that up. Mm-hmm. They have a special beef with the press that other Americans don't have, which is that the press tends to treat adolescents in an extremely negative way.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not too enthusiastic about the press. They're also kind of detached from the question in the survey was actually about newspapers, and newspaper readership is very low. And the other thing, though, is all the knowledge questions. I mean, the knowledge questions are disturbing.
What do you mean by that, the knowledge question?
When they don't know what's in the First Amendment or don't understand how it applies today or don't know, you know, under current law, does the government have the right to restrict indecent material on the Internet, et cetera, they're getting those things wrong. And there, I definitely don't think it's their fault, but I do think there's a whole lot of evidence that we're not teaching.
Hard to support it if you don't know what's in there. But, Ben, you're saying even when it's put right in front of them, you're getting pushback, and it's coming from a narrow... in your view, definition of morality?
Well, that could be, but I'm grateful to hear that the study. I'm one for research, not for anecdotes. So I'm grateful to hear that the study is really contradicting that.
Well, we're learning right along with you, Ben. Thanks for calling in from Spokane. Julia's calling from Boston. Hi, Julia. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm 25, and I have worked with middle school and high school students in educational settings.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking of my own education and what I've seen these kids going through, I think part of the problem is that it's not getting the material is not getting brought alive.
You mean that the civics teaching is too dull, it's too gray?
Yeah, and not just dull and gray, but not applicable to these kids' lives. I took U.S. history as a junior in high school and have a very vague memory of it. I've taken the time on my own to learn a little bit more about civics and government since then, but it was never brought alive for me and never made applicable to my life.
It would seem, Julie, easy to bring into life. There's so many hot issues that pertain to these freedoms, whether it's, you know, whether it's about gay marriage or porno on the Internet, or, I mean, the list goes on and on of things that pertain here. It would seem easy to make it lively.
Absolutely, but I think just like people have said before on the show, they're too hot, they're too scary, and people are afraid of going towards those issues. And also there's a lack of focus on critical thinking. And it's also been mentioned before on the show, but, you know, present the issues, don't be afraid of them, and let kids decide for themselves. People are too afraid of that. Teachers are afraid of that. In addition, then there's all the testing on top of it, so there's less time to focus on those critical issues and the gay marriage, just having a debate in class.
Julie, let me ask you, do you think the First Amendment goes too far?
Oh, absolutely not. And I don't think that I don't think that we would be able to live the lives that we do in this country. I wouldn't be able to live the lives that I do if we didn't have that.
Yeah, that's for sure. Julia, thanks very much for your call. Jean Polosinski, there's a call to make it more vivid, to sort of pump up the vividness of the education. I mean, civics classes were long considered kind of the yawn and snore, even back when they were more common than Peter Levine says they are today.
They were, and before we wax too nostalgic about those, I'd like to point out we looked at a book that was widely used in the 1950s, and it taught about the four freedoms of the First Amendment, two of which were wrong. So, I don't know that we've had that focus. We wish that we would, but I don't know that we've had that focus even in the past. I think clearly there are a lot of issues today that would really energize a classroom. What slogan can you wear in your T-shirt?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of music can you hear? What can you say in a school? But we live in a very litigious society as well. And let's face it, a lot of administrators get the advice from a school board attorney, you can't be sued for what doesn't go on or what you don't publish in your high school paper if you don't have one. And that's the advice, unfortunately, I think that's going out to an awful lot of educators today, is steer the middle course, don't be sued.
Keep your head down. Jack Beatty, wasn't President Bush saying just in the last day or two that he's a freedom of speech guy?
Well, yes, he was interviewed by Brian Lamb on C-SPAN on Sunday night, and Mr. Lamb asked him about pornography and about on the web and about television shows. You know, presumably he was thinking about things like the halftime extravaganza at the Super Bowl last year, what people should do about that. And Mr. Bush said, I am a free speech advocate. He said what they should do is parents should turn the dial off and they should monitor what their children are watching on the Internet.
But tell them why it's important that there's the freedom for it to be there and for them to get to it as adults if they want it. Nassar is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Nassar. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening.
Good evening.
I just wanted to say that if we play with the word freedom on its own, we're in big trouble, because freedom cannot exist without responsibility, and it has to have an umbrella of guideline that says freedom. Because you cannot have freedom to go rape a woman because you have a lustful nature.
Yeah, but wait a minute. Nassar, we're talking about freedom of speech. You want guidelines put around that? How tight do you want them? And then what happens to the fundamental American freedom?
I guess within moral guidelines, that you're free.
Moral guidelines. That would work in a theocracy.
Okay, you're saying freedom of speech should not come with responsibility?
Well, I mean, there's responsibility, but isn't the whole idea that the right will out, that get out there whatever's on your mind, and in the marketplace of ideas, the best ideas will win?
I guess my opinion of a nation that is going the right way would have to have some guidelines of responsibility to take the freedom to explode and foul language in...
We've got it, sir. We've got a rough line with you. But, Gene Polosinski, let me put it to you. You must hear this. It must not be uncommon. People saying, well, let's have some parameters here. You're the guy at the First Amendment Center. What do you say in response?
Well, we live in a society where we do have to have some limitations, time, place, and manner. I can't shout the same thing at high noon in a public square that I might at 2 a.m. under your window because I'll disturb the peace. But, you know, the caller does point out a very common, I think, misperception. He links actions and ideas. He talked about violence against women there for a moment. That's an action. We restrict actions in this country. But ideas, by the First Amendment, by the very nature of our country, have to be free. The First Amendment only exists to protect things on the fringe. If, you know, it's a speech we all agree on, or an idea or religion we all agree on, it doesn't need protection. The First Amendment's there to say, no, that idea that only perhaps one of us doesn't find repugnant has, as you pointed out, a place in the public marketplace. It doesn't guarantee anybody will like it or accept it or not even be repelled by it, but it has a place, and that's very fundamental to our society. We have a saying here that sometime in our culture, the land of the free became the land of the easily offended.
And that makes the thin skin all around. Peter Levine, it is remarkable that all these centuries after the document was drafted, the Bill of Rights is attached, and this is still an explosive issue, so explosive people may be afraid to teach it.
Well, and we want to have exactly the kind of discussion that just started with the caller in our classrooms. I mean, his position is a legitimate part of the debate.
And there it is. He's saying, let's look for some moral guidelines, and then you're off to the races with the conversation. Jack, I remain struck at what it is a revolutionary document. It still runs up against resistance right within the host country, right within the United States.
Yes, and if Jesus came for the sinners, you know, the Free Amendment, the First Amendment comes for the dissenters, comes for the people that stand outside, the people that stand up against the majority, stand up against the government, and speak their mind. It comes to people that aren't in many ways attractive, like the woman who got God out of the classroom. She was kind of a crank, but there she was. She was a dissenter against an almost unanimous opinion, and the court agreed with her. And so it's never going to win any popularity contest, that Bill of Rights, I'm afraid.
And yet there's a reason it's there. Let's hold the ideal up high. Everybody, young and old, let's get behind this one. Gene Polosinski at the First Amendment Center, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Peter Levine, Deputy Director at the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement in Washington tonight. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Jack, great as always to have you.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a new view on the minds of birds. This is On Point. Bird-brained has never been a compliment, but maybe it should be. A new group of researchers, the Avian Brain Nomenclature Consortium, has published an article in the journal Nature Reviews Neuroscience that challenges the common view that birds have less intellectual prowess than mammals. In this radio diary, consortium leader and Duke University neuroscientist Eric Jarvis shows some of the ways that some birds are more cerebral than many mammals.
One of them is the ability to imitate sounds. And we call this vocal learning. Vocal learning is the substrate for human language. Without it, you don't have spoken language. Well, chimpanzees don't have this ability to imitate sounds, but parrots do. Many songbirds do, like the minnow. And they can sometimes even imitate other species, like human speech, and reciprocally communicate with humans, such as African gray parrots, even at a very limited small vocabulary, but you can't get a chimp to do that with its vocalizations. Vocal learning is not the only behavior that some birds can do that's more advanced than mammals. There are others as well. Whether or not you're a vocal learner or not, you have others. One of them is tool use, and it happens to be done by a particular vocal learner, the crows. Crows can fashion tools out of twigs or man-made metal objects and bend them and use them to extract food from nooks and crannies. And they can apparently through observation, transmit that knowledge from one crow to another, and thus from, culturally from one generation to another. Pigeons, who these are vocal non-learners, but pigeons can have incredible visual memories where they can measure, remember up to 725 different visual patterns in a short period of time, something that's even a challenge for humans to do. They can lie. You can teach a female pigeon to do a trick that's going to pretend that a male pigeon is going to get food over in this corner of the box, and he thinks that it's going to be there, but it's not, and she goes and eats it from somewhere else. A lot of this learning that occurs in these birds, it's not only just learning amongst bird species, but it's also interacting with other species. And so it's been found that crows in Japan, and now someone just told me in our consortium, said I think crows in California are throwing nuts down on the streets as well. And what the crows in Japan do is that they wait for the cars to roll over the nuts, which cracks the nuts, and then they go down and feed. So they don't have to break it open with their own beaks. That's not an innate behavior. They figured this out over time. There's some birds who have incredible memories for food storing, particularly storing food over the winter. What they do, like scrub jays or black-capped chickadees, they will store these seeds in nooks and crannies, but sometimes they will actually pretend they store a seed in a place, but they don't. So other birds think they stored it there. And then later on in the winter, they come back and retrieve those seeds from the remembered locations, sometimes up to 3,000 different locations. This means that perhaps now that we are now saying birds are closer in their brain organization, not identical, but closer to mammals than what the common populace thinks, or even the common scientific population thinks, that therefore that will stimulate more science on the study of birds to understand things like human speech. And I believe that would happen. So they might say, well, that's poor for the birds and better for the rats. Rats can't imitate sounds. The other thing behind this is that as a scientist, it makes us more humbled about this hierarchy of trying to put humans at the top of an evolutionary, or not even an evolutionary tree if you don't believe in evolution, but at the top of some hierarchy. Yes, humans are quite advanced compared to most animals, but it means that you can't say that humans are part of a progression that led to that advanced behavior. There are multiple species, including multiple bird species, that have advanced behavior that is occurring in parallel with humans. It is breaking a misnomer as a community effort saying that the bird brain means stupid. That's what's in the Webster Dictionary. That's just completely scientifically inaccurate if you consider what stupid means.
Eric Jarvis is a neuroscientist at Duke University and a leader of the Avian Brain Nomenclature Consortium. The group's article on rethinking the bird brain appears in the February issue of the journal Nature Reviews Neuroscience. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Rachel Dornhelm, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Tim Skog and Michael Garth, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.